Mind Food Radio. Smart thinking with Michael McHugh.
Welcome to Mind Food Radio. In 2004, countless Thai children were left alone and homeless by the Boxing Day tsunami. Former police forensic specialist Peter Baines, who was working with the tsunami disaster victim identification team, was deeply touched by the number of children affected by the natural disaster. He was inspired to establish an organisation that could make a difference to at-risk children and their communities. 10 years later, the charity Hands Across the Water continues to lead a helping hand. Welcome to the show, Peter.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's a real pleasure.
Now, this is an amazing charity, and of course, we've done your feature, we've had your feature in the magazine, but can you describe for me that moment when you realised you had to do something more than what you were doing with these children?
I guess it was, I'd spent 3 months working over there doing the identification of the bodies and returning them home to those who, the relatives throughout the world, and was on my last rotation that I was working in Thailand. I visited the children who were living in a tent, and with a colleague of mine who I was working with, she actually suggested to me, or put the challenge out and said, do you want to do something to support the kids? And it just seemed the right thing to do. It wasn't as though it was I didn't recognise at the time that it had changed my life so much, but just seemed the right thing to do. And then I think the biggest moment when I realised that this was something that was going to really shape my future was when we went back 12 months later and opened the orphanage. And then I realised, then what happens? Who looks after the kids now? And that was really when I made that long-term commitment to bring about the long-term change for them.
Mm. Now, can I ask you to take you back in terms of that process of identifying bodies? And I know that was your specialist area in terms of the job that you had in Australia, but going into a disaster area like that and working for the amount of time you did, what sort of toll did that have on you mentally?
Yeah, it was, I guess it's something that at the time you don't think that, you think everything's okay. And then at different points I've reflected on the work that we're doing and the way that we were working over there, the hours that we're working, and the impact that it had on my life. And at the time, you think you're fine, but I know you can't work in those environments and not be touched in some significant way when you're dealing with the thousands of bodies and then dealing with the relatives as well.
In your training, though, because it's a very specialised training, and I guess it took years and years to train, let alone before you kind of got into the workforce and you know, did that, do they train you for that in terms of what you're seeing and going to be experiencing, or not really?
Oh, I think it's one of those things that there's to get into the area within the forensic services group where I was working as a crime scene investigator. You need to have worked in uniform in the police, and that's your introduction. And you see those guys at crime scenes, and obviously there's an interest, and you think, well, I'd like to pursue that. So you've been exposed to death, and when you get into the area, and your days are commonly filled with the investigation of scenes of homicides or suicides or fatal industrial accidents or whatever the cause might be, and. But then turning up into Thailand, we were seeing things that people hadn't seen before.
Yeah.
To turn up and see 3,500 bodies on the ground in one temple is not something that anyone of us who deployed over there had seen before, just because of the sheer scale. And so it's difficult to prepare for something like that. But in saying that, all of the forensic specialists who deployed had worked in similar areas as to I had. And so the seeing the death wasn't confronting. Perhaps the scale and the enormity of it was confronting for some. And I don't know that there's a lot you can do to prepare for that. It's a case of the organisations will offer services pre and post deployment, but it's such a difficult thing to judge how individuals who are confronted with the same set of circumstances, different people will respond differently. Mm. And as an organisation, to try and wrap a solution around that or a program that will ensure no one slips through the cracks is, I think, is something that is incredibly difficult to achieve.
I wonder, having sort of seen that firsthand and that volume of death and disaster, how many people, I wonder, have stayed in those jobs, you know, the job like you had, have actually remained in those sort of jobs? Like, it did have an effect that, you know, in time it perhaps was a bit much and left.
Yeah, I think that it was funny, and it's an interesting point you make. When I worked in Bali after the bombings, there were a lot of the people that I worked with in the senior area who then 2 years later or so I was working with back in Thailand, but many of my colleagues that I worked with in Thailand are no longer in that area. And it doesn't necessarily mean that they've left because of the trauma or that they couldn't cope. Many have been promoted and moved on to different areas, and even without Thailand, those people working in the forensic area and within the police and so forth, there's a constant move through the organisation and different positions. But it is an interesting observation that I know even after the 2009 bushfires in Victoria, many of the people who deployed into that in Victoria were experiencing their first large-scale DVI experience, which is an indication that so many of the people who had built up that corporate knowledge from Bali and Thailand were no longer deploying into that situation for one reason or another. And to your point, I'm sure that there's a number who left and made the choice not to be exposed to that again. But I think it's also just through the natural growth of individuals in their employment. Yeah.
What was it about, you know, being a forensic specialist that appealed?
It was funny. The reason I left uniform when I did, after 4.5 years, I worked at Cabramatta in Sydney, which was a very, very busy place, and I've been in the police for 4.5 years, and to be honest, I got sick of doing domestics. And I got sick of talking to drunks at 3 o'clock or 5 o'clock in the morning who all they wanted to do was fight, and I thought there's got to be more. And it hadn't been a passion to join the forensic area, but once I got in, just the intrigue, the variety, and particularly with the large jobs, to turn up and take control and then spend hours and sometimes days at the scene and then spend weeks and months later interpreting and analysing the results and what you'd found and then reporting to the court. And there are a number of jobs that I did in my time which were, there is no question that the brief was purely forensic evidence. There was no witnesses, there was no admissions, there was no CCTV, and it was a purely forensic brief. And those things were I look back and go, the highlights of my career, because you were providing answers to courts, to families, to inquests that otherwise wouldn't have existed but for your existence.
Mm. Now, listen, back to Hands Across the Water. How did you begin to set up that organisation?
It was a challenge, as I said, that Jill, who was working for the UK, she contacted me and we had a phone call and she said, do you want to build them a home? And I said, yeah, okay. She said, what are we going to call ourselves? And I said, well, you're in the UK, I'm in Australia, we're working with Thailand. How about Hands Across the Water? And we went, okay. And it was started as simple as that. And I was in a fairly difficult period of my life at the time and thought, well, I don't know how I'm going to raise money. And I'd been invited to speak on the corporate speaking circuit around the experiences and the lessons I'd learnt from working in these international crisis areas. And I'd been told about the opportunities that existed in that circuit. And I thought, well, if half of what I've been told is true, that's how I can raise the money. So I started speaking and getting paid, and then the payment that I got for speaking I used as donations towards the charity, and it grew and grew, And that was the start. And retrospectively, it was the best decision I could have made for the charity, was to fundraise in that perspective, in that way, because it's on average twice a week I'm speaking to a new group of people about leadership, about change, about clarity of purpose, and there's always stories about hands, because hands continue to evolve, and so I'm reaching new people all the way. So it was the corporate speaking, the public speaking, that really was the launching pad for hands, and remains so today.
And so how much money initially did you need to, you know, get started and build the orphanage?
The initial orphanage had a cost of $230,000, and there were a number of people that contributed to that first building, because there was fresh in the mind of people. There were connections through the Thai Stock Exchange who were putting money in. There were small donors, individual donors. There was Jill raising money out of the UK. I was raising money from here, and collectively the money came together and we were able to build it. But interestingly, and this is a pattern that I see, is that so many of those people who were there to build the first one no longer around, and many people move on, and many people think that the job's done once you've built them a home, but it couldn't be further from the truth.
Yeah. So in terms of that helping and to transform the lives of the children, you know, where is it at today?
Well, we started with 32 kids who had all lost their parents, and we opened the first centre, and those numbers doubled quite quickly. And the reason for them doubling was that there were too many international organisations, NGOs, charities, government and corporate, who just pulled out and thought their job was done. And so the numbers of our kids grew very quickly, and so I built another centre. Then we invested in the purchase of land for sustainable projects such as rubber tree plantation, palm oil plantation, fish farms, and so forth. And it's grown, and to the point now where, and people would think, well, is there still a need for the children from the tsunami? Surely that they're aged, and a lot of the kids that we first took in those 32. Are, you know, reaching their late teens and so forth, and those that were babies at the time, they're in their early teens, but we've continued to support them. Even the kids who came to us around 12 and 13 and so forth, we've now seen a number of them graduate from university with business and law degrees and marketing and all these different degrees that they wouldn't have had but for that continued support through to university. And it's interesting, the numbers of the kids we've got at the orphanage that was set up after the tsunami is at the highest point now than it ever has been. And there's plenty of young kids and babies that are taken in, because there seems to be no other option locally for them. But from a hands perspective, we've grown quite significantly. We now have seven centres across all of Thailand, and our latest project is a $1.5 million build up in the Chiang Mai region of the north of Thailand, where we're providing homes for 120 girls. It's all under construction right now, who have previously been trafficked in the sex industry. And within 12 months, we hope to have those homes open. And we run a HIV orphanage, which we took on close to four years ago. And when we took it on, the children were dying on a frequent basis. They were dying on a monthly basis, and at times on a weekly basis. And since we took them on, not one child has died. And it's been a wonderful turnaround, what we've been able to do with that orphanage. And then there's a number of other centres that we run across Thailand as well. And as I say, the growth of hands is just continues.
And how often would you be in Thailand? How often would you go up there?
Oh, probably over there six, eight times a year. And so in a few weeks I'll be, it's less than that now, but I'll be back in Thailand in January, where we run our annual bike rides, which are our main fundraising initiative. And I'll ride 1,600 kilometres over the 16 days with two groups of people who will ride 800 kilometres each, and we'll take 70-odd people over the two tours. And that's when I spend most time in Thailand. But I often fly over there for a meeting or so forth and fly back. So there's few occasions beyond the month of January where I'll spend more than a couple of nights over there at a time, because the best thing I can do is be back here working in Australia.
And where have you got the people to help you run these facilities? So these seven different places that you've built and putting up, are they mainly local people that you've hired, or where are they from?
They are just local people. So yeah. It's a position that I've been pretty strong on, is that we're caring for Thai kids in Thailand, and in my opinion, it should be run by Thais. And yeah. I've had a fairly strong philosophy or position on this, is that just because we have the ability to raise money and we do it well, doesn't mean we have the wisdom as to what's best for the children. And I think it's too easy to step into it. And we often have people who are representing hands who will make this mistake, and we have to caution them on it, is that they step in and have their own morals, their own values and their own beliefs around what's best. And we say, well, that's okay for you, but we don't impose that upon the Thais. And we don't impose religion, we don't impose conditions. And of course, there's governance and compliance around the running of the centre and the use of funds, but how they educate the children, how they discipline the children, that's up to them.
Have you had any help from local government level?
Not really. In Australia, we've got all of the compliance in order and approval to raise money and be tax deductible, and we've never really sought the assistance of government here in Australia, and to that point, we've never really sought out much assistance in Thailand as well. And part of it is the challenge and putting our energy and time into where we know we get the best results right now, and that's through the supporters we have. Doesn't mean that we're certainly not, government isn't in either country, doesn't stand in our way, but we haven't actively gone out seeking the support either.
Yeah. Well, look, I've got to say, you do an amazing job, Peter, and, you know, I take my hat off to you, as I know our listeners will, just listening to you, and that level of conviction that you have is to be admired. And I think from seeing something 10 years ago and now what you've built and created, and to help humanity along their journey for kids particularly that were less fortunate than us back here, you know, in Australia and New Zealand, is to be admired. So congratulations.
Thank you. That's very kind of you.
Now, in terms of fundraising, how do we help? Tell us where we need to go in terms of an online site, and what can we do?
Yeah, so handsacrossthewater.org.au is our website, and there's opportunities for people to either engage and become part of the experience themselves, whether it's in one of our bike rides where they ride, whether it's one of our renovation projects where they go over and be part of our task force where we really change the buildings, or whether they want to donate one of the riders who can ride on their behalf, or whether they'd even like to become a monthly supporter of the children. There's opportunities there. So there's heaps of opportunities through the website to explore it. And if anyone wanted to reach out to me personally, they can certainly do that. And my email is peter.baines@handsacrossthewater.org.au.
Thank you very much, Peter. All the
My
best.
My pleasure. Oh, same to you. Thank you. Bye-bye.
So for more details about Hands Across the Water and Peter, head to mindfood.com. And Peter's feature will be in our summer edition, the January-February issue of Mindfood.
Mindfood Radio. Smart thinking with Michael McHugh.